Good afternoon. Thank you for coming to a talk on AI. Thanks. Yeah, 2:30 in the afternoon after lunch. So let's get started. So we thought we would love to understand who is in the audience today. So could I please ask everyone to stand up?
Should we do it too? Yeah. We're going to do it too.
We'll do it too.
No, equality.
Woo, thanks. Okay, great. So please keep standing if you've heard of ChatGPT. Very good.
No please, one sits down.
No one sits down. That's amazing. It's a very sophisticated audience. Great. Please keep standing if you pay for ChatGPT Premium. Oh, a lot of payers here, though. They're doing well in this audience. Keep standing if you've trained your own models. Oh, wow. Cool. Okay, thank you. Cool. Thanks. Regardless of which one of those questions you answered yes to, we're really pleased to have you here. But also, really nice to see so many technologists in the audience. Yeah, woo for technology. Great. So we're gonna start with some introductions, because we always do. And we're going to try to do it with a twist, because we were discussing, like, you know, let's get this panel started in that way. So I'm actually going to introduce Heibu over there. So Heibu, so you can probably tell from my accent, I'm from London. We're actually all based in London, but from different parts of the world. So Heibu is currently in stealth mode, building a startup to address loneliness. But she's had a really fascinating career in AI. So used to lead product in autonomous vehicles, and then also worked at DeepMind, working on ethics and society, and combining products, machine learning, stakeholders, and policy to drive the best outcomes for society. She's got a PhD in atomic resolution imaging, which I call physics, from Oxford, 2 degrees from Cambridge, and is also a fellow at Sydney Sussex College in Cambridge as well. She also set up the London Interdisciplinary School, which is actually the first place that is allowed to issue degrees in the UK for 50 years, that is already an established university or college, which is very cool. She's a prominent angel investor. She advises lots of startups. And the thing that I admire most about Heibu is that you can never predict what she's going to say. I'll leave it, because I think a lot of people come with views that they've gathered or have a like particular mental models they use, but given Heibu's really interdisciplinary background, actually she's able to have a really wide and very interesting perspective, and I learned a lot from her. So thank you for coming, Heibu.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Yuelin. That was actually so much nicer than boasting about myself, because, you know, women. So I'm going to boast about one of the most amazing women in machine learning and product, Kate. Kate is one of these stellar women who actually started in machine learning before we even knew it was machine learning. It was data science back then. And she has had a varied and incredibly storied career, going from financial services, where there is a lot of data to be scienced, all the way through to applications in climate, in health, and in supply chains, in like every industry you can imagine, always with this bent of like, how can we make something useful out of this rather than just sciencing some data? Because, you know, that's fun, but not so valuable. The one thing I admire most about Kate is that her ability to learn and to make sense of the world so quickly is just phenomenal. And I think, especially in this world that's changing so fast, and we have a new model every third day and a robot that picks up your laundry every fourth day, it's absolutely imperative to be able to learn quickly, make sense of the world. So she's now making sense of financial wellness at Clio, which is one of, I think, is it London? London's really awesome startups that's trying to build something better for the future. So that's Kate.
Thank you, Heibu. This introducing each other, I think, has really turned out particularly well for all of us. So thank you for your generous introduction. So I'm Kate, and I have the privilege of introducing my fellow panelist, Claire Woodcock. Claire is a particularly established product leader and operates incredibly well in the intersection of technology and positive human interaction. She has an incredibly sought-after career that spans multiple domains and has a huge amount of experience building and delivering products with AI and machine learning at the core. Her domain expertise encompasses multiple industries, including entertainment, finance, healthcare, biometrics, and more recently, social media. Claire's practical career is impressive on its own, but it's extended by the fact that she is also a published author in the field of explainable and trustworthy AI. She's currently serving as the Director for Products for Machine Learning at Mozilla Social and continues to push the boundaries for responsible product development. Claire is a deeply critical thinker, and I think her superpower comes from the fact that she has a deep technical understanding of machine learning and AI and couples that incredibly well with commercial viability. That allows her and her teams to not only envision, but also realize how technology can really benefit humanity. So welcome, Claire.
Thank you. Testing. No. Oh dear, I'm going to have to pass the mic. Thank you so much. Wow, introducing each other is really beautiful. So I get to introduce Yunan Lee, who is our moderator, and she is currently Chief Product Officer at Onfido, which is a UK identity verification company which has artificial intelligence at its core. And Onfido is currently being acquired by Enact, and this is the largest VC-backed exit in the UK for several years, so congratulations to Yunan. So Yulin cut her teeth at JP Morgan and then numerous other startups, which include Faculty AI, and she is also a very prominent UK angel investor, so she's very active in the UK tech scene. And what I really just love and admire about Yulin is that she is just wildly smart, and the ideas come thick and fast, and so she's our moderator today, but I'm really looking forward to making sure that she has she's sharing all of her opinions and insight because she has so much to share, and I'm really excited to hear those views. So thank you.
Thank you, Claire. Well, that worked way better than I expected and was the first time I've ever done that on a panel. So thanks for the suggestion. Okay, great. So that's enough about us. What we actually want to know, given that this is AI talk number, I don't know, like 1,224 this week. There's been a lot of AI this week. You probably sat through a lot of them. So we want to make this interesting for you. So I would love, if anyone's comfortable, just shout out, what are the topics you want to hear about today?
How to change the nature of work for the average knowledge worker.
How to change the nature of work.
How it will change.
How it will change the nature of work for the average knowledge worker. Like it. I mean, you know what, I'm just take notes. That's what you think.
That's a spicy level one chili. Mm. I'm looking for a spicy level two chilies, if any of you feel brave enough.
Okay, great. Noted. We will get to that. Any more? For any more?
Why do you think it's important for women to be more involved in building AI?
Oh, spicy level two achieved.
Love it. Women in AI.
Anyone want to do a vindaloo curry spicy level?
Spice level three. Any more?
Your thoughts on privacy and AI. Data privacy and AI.
That is very spicy. Bit. Noted. We will get to all of these questions and some topics as well. Any more from this side of the room?
Which industries is AI more applicable for work?
Which industry? Okay, very good. I like that question. Thank you. I would say medium spicy rather than super spicy. We will definitely get to that one. Interesting. Great. Any more?
I don't know the spiciness level.
We take all spiciness levels.
Well, have you seen the role of especially the UN designer or design strategies in creating new meaningful products using AI? Because now they talk a lot about synthetic personas and all the AI, your research, was kind of up to date when you do the product. So, like,
UX designer, design strategist, and their role going. Great. Any more?
Is there a threshold where AI becomes counterproductive to us?
Oh,
spicy level 4.
That's spicy. Productive to us. Perfect.
I'll try spicy. AI is not truly being implemented in most industries.
Not spicy. No, I'm joking. That's a great one. Okay, AI and actual implementation. Yep. Perfect. Okay, any more? Otherwise, I'll jump into some of these topics, some of the topics we'd come back. Oh, last one, please.
Yeah, how is AI going to influence entrepreneurs of the future?
Influence entrepreneurs of the future. Yeah. Okay, love these. Thank you. Did someone else have their hand back there? Please, go ahead.
To what extent AI would exacerbate current issues tech has in terms of loneliness, mental health, sustainability?
Every societal issue that we exacerbate societal issues, absolutely. I'd put that as very, very spicy. That's
We're on fire.
Yeah, I know. Thanks.
This is awesome.
This is absolutely awesome. Yeah, thanks for okay, great topics. We could actually just we're going to start with a few questions, and we're going to weave these in as well. I think I'd say about half of these were covered in some of the stuff we're going to talk about, and some of these we'll answer more directly afterwards. And a gentleman over there who had their hand up.
How AI impacts transportation?
I'm really sorry. I heard transportation, but not beyond that. Automation landscape. Perfect. Well, definitely have lots of views on that. Thank you. Transport. Okay. Super. Well, thank you very much for all your participation. Let's get into some of the meaty topics. So one of the things we discussed as a panel, because I think a lot of people have been saying very high-level things about AI, and actually we are sort of in the thick of it, building products with AI and seeing much more of what's actually happening from a practical application. But when we set up this panel, we actually made it quite future-facing because we weren't sure what South by Southwest AI panels were going to be like. So we're going to kick off with one about the future, and then we'll come back to some of these other ones. So each of us work in quite different industries, have worked in multiple different industries. Please pick one industry and say what you think this will look like in 10 years' time. And we're going to start with Kate.
All right. So as Hebe mentioned, I've worked in a couple different industries, but I'm going to choose focus on financial services, and particularly because it's such a broad topic, for the sake of brevity, what I'll choose to talk quickly on is personal financial services. And I think to date, we've really not seen the killer personal financial solution come to market. If you have one, I would love to hear about it. I personally do not have one. And there's a couple of reasons for this. It's not like there haven't been entrepreneurs that have come into the space to try and solve this problem. How can we help people to optimize and automate some of their personal finances? But the trend has largely been that entrepreneurs have come into the space, realized that there are structural problems downstream, and chosen to work on those problems. Some examples are online payment processing or fraud mitigation, for example. But now, I think a lot of work has happened in the last 10 to 15 years. And now digital finance, and particularly digital personal finance, I think is really well poised to deliver a really killer personal financial solution. And this is something that we're looking to do at Clio, and we do that at the moment through a conversational interface and try and create an experience where you can have a simple conversation about your finances with Clio. Naturally, we use AI data and machine learning to also automate some financial activities and also deliver deeply personalized insights to help you understand your spending, which is very helpful for a lot of people. But importantly, we want to help you achieve your goals and improve your financial health. And I think that is really the forward-looking face of personal finance, and it's in the name. personal finance. And I think why solutions have failed is because generic financial advice doesn't really apply to people because it's really personal, your financial situation. You have your own unique goals, circumstances, constraints, and generic personal advice doesn't really help you execute against that. And I think there's some anecdotal evidence to suggest that. For example, about 67% of Americans cannot meet a $400 unexpected expense. But we all know it's probably good to have an emergency fund. So how can we really help people along their personal financial journey? And I do think that AI and its ability to personalize experiences is something that's really going to be incredibly beneficial in this area. So I'm thinking of personal financial plans, advice that can be tailored to you, and really help you achieve your financial goals. All right, I'll hand it over.
Awesome, so financial services, Claire, what's your industry?
Checking I'm on. Ah, yes, brilliant. So my area that I'll speak on is social media, and I'm going to go for a 3 chili level of spice with this. Yes. So the question is, what does social media look like in 10 years? And I actually think that we'll see a lot of emerging technology coming together in this space. So if we think about combining generative AI with extended reality, we're already seeing hints of this with the Apple Vision Pro and the Memojis for FaceTime being animated. They look absolutely terrible, I know, but the reason why they look so bad is because we can't handle seeing ourselves animated in that way right now. I mean, let's be clear, NERFs exist. So if Apple or Meta wanted to do this, they would. So I think that's going to be the direction of travel. So today, what is social media? It's where people meet and they connect and they share ideas and form friendships and maintain them online. What does that look like in 5 to 10 years in that situation? I think we will be meeting up in virtual environments synchronously or asynchronously with our digital, very realistic avatars communicating on our behalfs. And that brings in some really interesting interactions because right now, all we only think about is sharing content and information in social media. But imagine a world where you are animating your avatar. Actually, if you don't want someone to know that you're experiencing a particular emotion, you can actually hide that. So imagine a future where you are actually controlling your real-time avatar and you're also thinking about your body language when you're on social media. So I know this sounds very out there, but I really do think that this is very plausible because we're already seeing things like people training LLMs over their WhatsApp chat history so that those LLM agents can actually respond in group chat for them. So it sounds pretty out there, but I do think it's a potential future for social media where we're having these really surreal experiences and we're really communicating synchronously and asynchronously, potentially even having our avatars communicating with other people's avatars on our behalf, so it all gets a little bit layered as well. So that's my view for the future.
I love that spicy. I'm also really terrified of that future. So many ethical questions around what is truth? How do we authentically still be ourselves? I wondered if you could comment on that.
So I think that's the future left unchecked. Yeah. And as with all technologies, the question is, you know, what choices do we want to make? But certainly that's the direction of travel at the moment. And, you know, there are situations where I really don't want to have to communicate my emotion to someone. And I'd love to be in a stressful situation and be able to have a very kind of moderated expression. But is that great for human interaction in a social space? I'm pretty sure Havu has a lot of opinions on that. So I think it depends on the use case, and I think these are all the big gnarly questions that we'll have to think through as we start seeing that tech emerge.
Yeah, I've already seen this happening in, I guess there was an all hands at the startup that I was with last where a really excellent engineer who had English not as his first language was asked potentially quite early in his tenure at the company to stand up and talk about quite a controversial feature that he was experimenting with. And he used Synthesia to essentially write what he wanted to say, edited, and then it basically created an avatar of his very lifelike face. And it wasn't him presenting, it was this avatar presenting in front of the whole company. And actually for some of the people in the company, that was his first impression for them. Obviously, this technology is amazing because he looked really lifelike and he delivered a great presentation, which was very well understood by a lot of people, but it wasn't him. It was the avatar of him. And the question I asked, like, my friends, you know, the sort of managers of these teams is, like, what is the point? Where do you draw that line of, like, giving a person support so that they can learn to do this kind of human interaction? Because it is a really important part of our ability to function in teams, to eventually lead teams. And if we don't practice that, if we don't fail and get up and try again, then are we really learning? Versus, you know, sometimes in a startup, sometimes in a company, you just have to move really fast. And this is a really great way to support somebody to move really fast. I personally veer on the former, which is you should always build human capability first rather than automate the shit out of everything. Sorry, I shouldn't swear. But yeah, I think, you know, the future you're describing, Claire, like it's definitely the direction of travel. And I think we really need to make choices as managers, as parents, as friends. Like, are we okay with letting people take these shortcuts? Mm. I say no, but personal opinion.
Oh, shall we just go really spicy? So I'm a parent of two young children, and actually on that topic, I think especially when they're younger, right, this is not you need to be there, but they do, the majority of children want to feel some connection or need to build a connection or attachment of some form with at least one caregiver, and that is a human interaction, not a virtual interaction. So I'm sure many people, including me at times when I'm very tired, wish I could click my finger and bypass some of those interactions, but that is the brain and attachment, and at least so far the theories I've read on that. And so maybe if you already have that level of security, then you don't mind replacing all of this with an avatar and just going forward. But if that, then where do you draw the line, right? Because you can also just put them in front of the TV or the iPad and do something else, and maybe that attachment never forms, and then what does that mean for humans? I don't know. These are gnarly problems. What was the industry you were going to choose?
I had several, but since we had a question on transportation, I'd love to dig in on that. So at Wave, which is still a British machine learning end-to-end deep learning approach on autonomous driving, one of the questions we had to ask ourselves is, like, how does the rest of the transportation logistics industry need to change for machine learning to be useful? We picked a use case, well, mostly because we thought, you know, if a cabbage gets bumped by a slightly weird left turn, it's not going to complain as much as a human. So we chose the use case of delivering groceries and found some partners to help us, like, pilot that. And then we ran into this problem of, like, well, what happens when you automate one part of that user experience, which is getting the cabbage or whatever else, not everyone loves cabbages, from the superstore or the market to the front door of your customer? Like, how do you then do that last mile? And lots of ideas were mooted, like maybe some, you know, leg robots, like the Boston Dynamics kind of dog that climbs up your stairs. Terrible dystopian future. But actually what we ended up realizing is that, you know, often a product is a whole combination of technology, of operations, of like human interaction. And you can't just replace all of it with AI. There are some bits that are still necessary to be operational. And I think it's probably fair to say that even the autonomous vehicles driving around San Francisco and other deployed cities have a lot of operations in the background just there to make sure that everything goes okay. So I think in the future, we're going to end up with actually ways in which the whole process of logistics needs to change, with different docks, for example, at warehouses, so that autonomous vehicles can be docked without a human having to, like, lift the pallet off. But without that change, the promise of autonomy isn't going to be realized. And that change, that operational change, is actually really hard to do, because most businesses, especially in these low-margin industries, have optimized to having those operations be incredibly efficient and incredibly, like, cost effective. So asking them to change that is a huge, huge capital investment and a huge retraining and re-optimization of their processes. So we see this in supply chains, we see this in logistics, we see this where a lot of autonomy has its promise, but I think it's going to get, I don't know, 10 years for that operational change to get realized. We also see this in manufacturing, where, yeah, it's the same problem. So I think if you are working with AI, if you are trying to build products with AI, I would encourage you to think of it as a systems problem, not just as a technology problem, because usually you won't get the value unless you get everyone involved in that operational change. I don't know if you guys have seen the same.
I was also just going to add to that, if you have to think of a future of autonomous vehicles, and if you're at work, why wouldn't your car go out and make money on your behalf, maybe by being a ride-sharing car? And then you think about the built environment, and what happens to parking lots if your car's not parked because it's working while you're working. And I think that that also speaks to like the larger changes that I think we need to think about at a systems level, not only from an operational level, but what does our built environment look like? How are our cities designed in the case of transportation? And how would that change in a future where we have something like autonomous vehicles really at the heart of our ecosystem?
Yeah, and I would also echo that I've seen this and again, going for a three chili level spice story. I used to work at health tech, and it was a digital health provider, teledoctor, but ultimately at some point you do need to test your humans to figure out what's wrong with them. And we were working in a tech office in the middle of London, and I remember someone walking into the ladies' toilets and saying, someone's posted me a poo, and it's because they had posted their biological sample to the tech office because they thought that was how they were meant to do their doctor's tests. So when we're talking about changing logistics and changing the infrastructure, this is kind of pointing to Haby's example of, you know, the whole human perception and interaction of how you interact with these technologies has to be updated. And actually people, if you don't really explicitly design it, people can generate some very interesting understandings of how your business is operating.
Yeah, and I think this touches on the point of, like, why is design important? What does design look like? I would say that we're on this cusp of, like, you know, the whole interaction and systems that we have for moving things around, like getting doctor's tests. It's all going to change because we have this promise, but the promise won't be realized unless we design it with, like, a human in mind, because a human will send poop to a tech office otherwise. And yeah, I think the other spicy thing I would add to that is I know there's been a lot of really big VC raises for synthetic, biotech, drug discovery, AI startups. Like some of the valuations I've seen are like insane. It's incredible. And if you look at the processes of what it takes to get a drug to market, why it costs billions and billions, and you actually go talk to the people in the pharma companies developing this, there's still not a synthetic model of a human being that allows people to like test these things in like an ML environment. A lot of it is upstream in the drug discovery. It helps you find ideas faster, but the part that's really slow and the part that needs to be slow and really careful is the human trials and the way that we get there. And machine learning hasn't yet touched that. And so I don't think we're going to discover masses of drugs much, much faster just because we've got more targeted ideas up at the top of the funnel. So I guess spicy level four, I question, yeah, is this the best use of machine learning? And actually, are there other models of data and process optimization that's going to help us get to drugs faster?
Ooh. I'm just going to jump in a bit because there was the really great question about UX design and design strategies. I think where I operate, we have AI at our core. Like the core is a lot of machine learning, a lot of computer vision and so on. But actually, we also are a design-led company at the same time. And the squads that build the products have that interface with researchers, engineers, product managers, and designers. And the designer's role is as important as all of the other roles. And I think some of this is
obviously about like business outcomes, right? Around usability or for us like success criteria or like, you know, time to value and so on. But some of it is also actually thinking through, are you even asking the right questions? And does this system make sense? There are so many ways, which I think what we've talked about is sort of like local maximization, right? You're like, I have maximized this bit of pharmaceuticals, or I have maximized, like in my world, it would be like the accuracy of this part of this thing. But that's only that part, right? The system is much broader. And I think that's where designers really, that's their superpower. They can think across lots of different things. And so you're not stuck in these suboptimal equilibria that are easier to measure or easier to run models on when they're not the part that necessarily drives the biggest impact in the end. So huge fan of designers and UX and user research in like modern product building.
Yeah, I would really choose to underscore that. And I think what we can't forget is that even though AI is awesome and we're going to see some real fundamental changes to products, it really makes up the part of the technical solution that helps us solve a customer problem. But your end goal is still to solve a customer problem. And that person is a human. And we have not absolutely in any way possible, you know, solved for AI to build systems or to design systems that a human uses. And I think that there are tools that will help to augment designers in the future. They already exist today. But in the end, we do have to remember that there's a human at the end of this product, and we have to design for that human in mind. And I think that that is the designer skill set, as Yulin mentioned. And I think that now more than ever, or probably forever, designers are really key, and they're just as key as the technology that sits behind the product.
Okay, so there we had two very interesting questions about which industry are AI applications actually happening in, and also spicy on the other side, which is implementation of AI is going slower than expected. I hope I'm not paraphrasing incorrectly the intent. So, and I think we would agree with that actually. Like, there's a lot of AI development that's happened, especially at the foundational layer, but in terms of real application in industry, and in it is still early. And part of that's just human nature. You could have an amazing model that comes out, but for especially bigger companies to incorporate that into what they do, it could just take years. Years to get through procurement, years to get through legal, years for people to change their behavior. And so it hasn't fully permeated industries, and I don't think that's a controversial opinion. Given we have these IDs on panel, I'm gonna ask is, what are the inflection points that you think that will come up in the next few years that will really accelerate this implementation of AI in industry?
I'm going to start with one, which was the point where I realized that although autonomous vehicles are very valuable, it's not for me. There's other things to build that I want to focus on. So I don't know how much you guys are familiar with developer frameworks and tools like LangChain or LlamaFlow. But the point at which these things started coming out and becoming widely accessible, they're basically like tools that help you use an LLM much, much more flexibly, much more easily. You don't have to have as much software engineering capability to or experience to deploy a model. I think right now, I mean, having used a few of them, they're like, okay, but I would never really put them into production in a, you know, really critical use case. I think there's going to be a huge inflection point when some of these frameworks become really, really powerful. And the reason why I'm excited about this happening in the next few years is I draw this analogy of where we're at now with models and Gen AI and basically just more like open source availability of machine learning with where the internet was when GeoCities, if any of you are old enough to remember that. GeoCities, yes? Okay, good. I remember my first GeoCities website. It was terrible. It had the like ants going around the, yeah, it was not, I'm not a designer. And it was amazing because suddenly everyone could make a website. You didn't have to be an HTML, CSS expert. You could put your stuff out there. And I think we're at the same point with models. With a lot of these APIs, and as they get more sophisticated, everyone can build something. And so as an angel investor, I'm seeing a whole bunch of my friends, especially those who've been laid off in the, you know, tech layoffs, getting really excited about building companies, building agents that solve specific problems that are really, really valuable, like booking your hotel or helping you pass the accountancy exams. And they're able to do it as one person with limited software engineering background. And I think we're just going to see more and more of that capability because we're going to start, in this era, everyone not just building a website, but building our own agents. And I'm so excited about that, and I think it's coming in the next couple of years. So keep an eye on those frameworks.
Amazing. Claire?
So in terms of my perspective on inflection points, I think one is already happening, but we won't realize for a few years. So I think a lot about data and data quality. And so as we all know, everyone stood up, you use ChatGPT, you know that it's trained by hoovering up lots of data, and we train over it, and we get pretty good results out of it. What we also know is that that data that's generated from an LLM, if it's fed back into the model, it poisons the model, and the model collapses. So what we're doing right now is we're polluting our data environment as we speak with the LLMs that we're using. On top of that, people in creative industries are starting to use tools like Nightshade to protect their creative works, which is a good thing. But it also means that the data environment is being poisoned because that is designed to make the model fail if it's fed into the model. So this kind of free-for-all phase that we're in right now, where models are just training over all of this data, I think it's actually a short blip. And what's going to happen fairly soon is the companies who are really going to succeed and accelerate through this phase are the ones who are really paying attention to making sure they've got trusted data, data they're allowed to use, data that they really understand the provenance of, that they can rely on, that's going to power their models in the future. So for me, I think the inflection point is happening with people designing responsible data collection practices right now, but you won't actually see the impact of that for a couple of years.
Interesting. So this is like social media 2007 to 2015.
Yeah, but I think it applies to all industries. So in social media, I mean, obviously you have misinformation and those kind of things going out there, which again, if it gets fed back into a model, it could learn all kinds of crazy things. But even in something as simple as like image generation, if you're generating poisoned images and collapsing your models, if you are a company who specializes in identity verification, actually you having your proprietary data set, which you know you can trust and you understand that you have the rights to use it and what's contained within it, is going to be such a key piece of IP for you in the future, even more so than it has been today. And we've known for a long time that data is crucial to machine learning.
I'll quickly touch on the question that we had around AI not really having too much impact in industries over the last year, and then I'll move on to the inflection points. And so I think that we all agree that we haven't really been able to see AI applications really permeate a lot of industries to date. There's a couple of reasons for that. One, I would say, would be that humans are particularly good at overestimating what we can do in the short term in the realm of about a year. And we're really good at underestimating what we can do in about 3 to 5 years' time. And I think that this is exactly what happened kind of post ChatGPT going mainstream. There is a single, I think, learning, that you've probably heard already. It's very easy to create an impressive prototype. It's still very difficult to create a robust, reliable model that is scalable in production. And that remains a challenge today. However, we have seen incredible developments. I just think it's not been in the application layer yet. We've seen amazing developments in the model layer at places like OpenAI, Google, Anthropic, you name it. And I think that this is okay. If we think about an analogy compared to the mobile revolution, the iPhone came out in 2007, and it took about 2 years for really amazing game-changing applications to come off the back of that. I think, for example, I think Uber kind of came around 2009. It's about a 2 year difference. I expect roughly the same amount of time from when we have these epic foundation models to when we start seeing the application layer really deliver. I think it may be a bit shorter, potentially, but I do think it may be 2024, 2025, we should be seeing some applications really coming to market. So, yeah.
Can I disagree with that?
Yeah.
Because I think you said something really interesting. Which I think we don't talk about enough, which is these models are not production grade yet. They're not good enough for you to just leave them out there and do their thing. You always need a backstop of some human or an operations thing, like picking up the stuff that goes wrong. Because when a customer service call goes well and automated, fantastic, you saved yourself some money. But if it doesn't and you have a really angry customer, you better have something to pick up that shortfall. And I actually think that, you know, the way we all consider products is like, what is of that value to the human or the process on the other side? And like, I don't think the models are good enough yet for us to just leave them on their own, because it's not valuable unless you get to like 99.999% robustness. I think the way I think about it is actually these models are a little bit like the Wi-Fi that you, or, at least it's at the bottom of my Maslow's need hierarchy triangle, like no Wi-Fi, no go. But if your model fails, then there's so much stress that gets basically dumped into your product experience that, you know, a lot of, I hear a lot of people ask, you know, is it worth it? So I think it's going to take longer, one. And two, I think that actually the way we think about these models as like co-pilots means that humans will still end up having a lot of work to do. But the work that we do is not the blank page stuff of like, oh, where do I start? It's not like, oh, I need to write like a, you know, for loop for counting. That sort of, you know, the boring stuff, I guess, can get automated by some of these models. You can, you know, generate amazing videos of women walking through Tokyo in like a one prompt. But at the end of the day, the soul of our creative expression in code or in media, you're never going to automate that. And you're always going to need a human to do that extra last step to make it from okay, I trust it a bit, to good, to great.
So what I hear though, is that actually then there is the model that, or models, or model-driven products that interface directly with the end consumers or your customers, businesses, all people, and those still need work, and actually companies are incorporating those, will be more risk-averse because of the negative consequences of things going wrong. But the transformation could happen inside the company itself, where they do have these humans. So you can imagine a world, say, where humans look at, I don't know, like, let's say customer service inputs, like they have to analyze, or sorry, humans have to handle 1 million a month. And then you use these models to automate some of those, but you're not doing it entirely and that there is no humans. In fact, the humans are actually part of that loop of training models. But in terms of efficiency for the company, it would be more efficient. But in terms of the what we will see from the outside about that industry, the change is not so visible.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, like, you know, we still want to be treated as humans that are respected and have dignity. I don't think that's hopefully ever going to go away, although so much conflict in the world makes you wonder. But I think, you know, the mind-blowing demo that I saw the other day was when a customer service model could be interrupted and there was like a 48 millisecond lag of them not, like, of responding. So you could have a real conversation with this agent. And that obviously saves a business a lot of money because then they don't have to have a human on the other side fielding all of these calls. But that innovation, that like step of, you know, seamless interaction, that I think is the piece that needs to be worked on. And that's not a model is larger, has more context. That's a performance issue. So in the way that Spotify, I think, blew everyone's mind because it loaded your music way faster than, you know, semi-illegal pirate downloads, the user experience of this is going to be absolutely key. And whether it's a human providing that amazing user experience or whether it's a model, like, we're still always going to want to have a good experience, or at least I always want to have a good experience. I don't know about you guys.
I think, and Haibu, completely agree, and quickly coming back to the inflection point, and this is one that I think we need to see quite quickly, and that is one of evaluation. And it's exactly coming back to what we've mentioned a couple times now, is particularly in the realm of generative AI, where you have a model output that is in the form of text or an image, it's not clear if that is the correct text or image. It's actually very difficult to evaluate that. In the case of a large language model, if you're building a chatbot, how do you know you're having the right conversation? How do you know the quality of the conversation is at the point at which it's acceptable for your customer? That evaluation at scale is very difficult because your output is actually subjective. So is a good conversation a long conversation? Well, sometimes, but is a good conversation a short conversation in the case of customer service? Well, potentially. And so scaling out your evaluation is very, very difficult. And I think that this is a bottleneck that we're seeing in the industry, same with image generation. And I think for us to really see the kind of first wave of applications come to market that have high performance, that are robust and scalable, we have to have sorted out this evaluation point. And this is something that's very close to my heart. I work on it day to day. It's a very tough thing, but we have to start thinking about quality frameworks and metrics and how we evaluate those within the design process and when the model is in production. And right now, you can eyeball it, you can have humans look at it after the fact, but not in real time. You can also have, in the case of textual output, an LLM assessing the output of another LLM, but those assessments are not consistent, which is tricky in and of itself. So we've still got some challenges there, and I think that that's an inflection point we're going to need to see sooner rather than later for the first wave of consumer apps to come to the forefront.
Hey, so we had a couple of really interesting questions from the audience about women and AI, about AI and society, and actually all of these things are very connected. So this South By, actually, we've seen so many amazing female speakers on the AI and other tracks. I've personally felt really inspired by some of the panels I've gone to. So in a future where gender has been treated as fairly as it should be, what has changed?
So my boyfriend and I have this long debate every other Sunday night, which maybe is too much insight into my relationship, but he's a software engineer, a roboticist, and I ask him, and we debate, what would the world look like if all roboticists were female? Would we have solved the t-shirt folding problem much sooner? Because folding laundry is a pain in the... it's real pain. Would we have solved other problems, like women's health? Much, much sooner. I'm so excited at South by the number of entrepreneurs working in this space, gathering the data, making sure that women actually are represented in medical studies, because apparently that didn't happen for quite a while.
Until it was the 1990s that women were included in medical studies.
Yeah, so apparently we were being prescribed as if we were men. Great. But I think that representation of, like, you know, what are the problems that are most salient to you if you are from a different background, not even a different gender. Like, I really love your question, wonderful woman in the audience whose name we didn't get, about, like, what does tech do in terms of concentration of power and concentration of resources? Because the people who have the resources are going to build the things that they care about. And what I'm seeing a lot of is people with resources building things that make us work faster, work longer, run faster, be more productive. It's very productivity oriented, which is great because everyone wants to be more productive. And frankly, we don't have any other metrics of status other than how hard we work these days. But if there were more women building, if there were more women writing checks, which I think in the US is still, what, 23% of funding goes to female entrepreneurs still, and 2% to all female founders.
2% to all female founders, yes.
23% to founders with one female on the team. And check writers are still 15% women. Like, we're just not getting the brain share of, like, problems. So I guess maybe ask your female, your neurodiverse, your people from different backgrounds, you know, what are the problems they care about? Because I, for one, think that we'll have lots of productivity apps, and some of them will be great, but there's a lot of them. And do we need all of them? I don't really think so.
I'd love to build on the healthcare point as well, because if you think about the fact we didn't have medical data mandated for women until the 1990s, we just have such a huge gap in longitudinal healthcare data that we can actually draw from to treat people. And, you know, everybody knows a female that they care about, or they have a pot plant that's female and, you know, want to love and protect. And so this is a huge opportunity for the healthcare industry to really kind of use AI to leapfrog where we were, because we can use these tools to really understand what we haven't managed to pick up on so far about how to treat half the world's population. So women respond to drugs differently, they metabolize them differently, they express diseases differently, hormonal health, fertility health, these are all things that haven't really been touched on by modern medicine. And I think in the future, we're gonna see much better healthcare for the whole population, even though AI in healthcare is across the board extremely exciting. So I'm very optimistic about that.
I think maybe a good, I'll start with a quick example. So during COVID-19, there were around 50 million women globally that exited the workforce in order to take on additional caregiving duties. I'll just kind of put that stat over here and then give another one. Around 99% of Fortune 500 companies use a system called an ATS, an applicant tracking system, in order to screen CVs. And there was a study done at Harvard Business School where a professor interviewed over 2,000 CEOs, and 50% of these CEOs said that they knew their ATSs were blatantly disregarding applicants that had a career break of more than 6 months on their CV. Now, this actually happened, and this story broke in like 2021, 2022. It's not particularly new, but it's a really good example of how technology that is often powered by AI can really discriminate against different people. And I think there's two takeaways here that I want to really underscore. One, if you are building a product that is serving a diverse customer base, representation in the building and evaluation of those models really matters, particularly in the evaluation side of things, because you really want to minimize the blind spots in your team. We're humans, we have biases, and I think that is something that we need to acknowledge, but we really need to focus on how we can mitigate that. And then secondly, this comes back down to metrics, and you can probably tell I'm a product manager because we talk about metrics a lot. But how are you thinking about your metrics? What does success look like for your customer? Does success look different for different customers? And how do you encode and imbue nuance into your metrics? And then secondly, have guardrails and counter metrics to make sure that you're providing a safe experience for different people. If we're building technology that is replicating or trying to replicate a human decision, we have to be more nuanced in our approach. And that would be something that I'm looking forward to in the future.
Yeah, we're actually seeing quite a lot. The good news is we're seeing a lot of market pressure, especially from larger enterprises, around things like bias and fairness with regards to models. This is something that really has only come up in the last couple of years. I think the idea of accessibility for inclusivity has been broader, but demographic bias, at least in my industry, is something that's much more recent. And I think, you know, industries change where the money changes. And if large enterprises are not willing to like sign on suppliers who don't have great model governance or fairness or haven't put the effort into this, then that will shift the industry. That said, doing this is really expensive because it comes back down to this data, and to be able to access data that you have the right consent for, that is, that will balance your data sets, I think will get increasingly expensive. It's not something that is for free, and therefore would also, just by design, I think, balance the power towards bigger companies, more established companies, to be able to serve them. So it was interesting. I think definitely positive sides, but also this concentration of wealth and power and data that is playing out. That's my day job, so I'm seeing lots of positive signs. I think, though, on the angel side, actually, despite all the noise and lots of, you know, we just passed International Women's Day, now it's like Women's History Month, like tagged on lots of different things, asked to go to lots of panels, but fundamentally, the share of funding has not changed. And given where we are right now in the funding cycle, and this idea of that you've done it before and exited before, becoming a much stricter criteria across a lot of firms, at least in London, and base, actually just significantly biases against female founders. And so on one side, you hear a lot of noise. I think
women especially end up giving quite a lot of, emotional labor almost, and contributions from the community point of view. But in terms of like the cold hard cash that actually really matters and getting the big tickets and large checks to really grow and scale a company and being able to spend 6-7 figures on data to balance your models and so on and so forth, the numbers are the numbers and the numbers aren't shifting.
I'm optimistic, Yelin. I think, you know, I don't know if this is my bias, but I've been to a lot of panels at South By where everyone is talking about the loneliness crisis. Thank you, Surgeon General, for publishing this amazing report, because at some point, social connection became social media, and social media is not connecting, it's performing. Like, those of you in media know that it's a performance art. It's not about, like, deep, meaningful fuzzies. Well, maybe, you know, when you receive the performance and it moves you, but I think what's really, really interesting is that there are health crises, there are societal crises, there is sustainability that's driving dollars to problems that I see a lot of women care about. I see a lot of women stepping up and saying, this is something I want to help solve. So I guess our ask is like, you know, can we all try and solve those problems together? Because if those are where all the really cool ideas and all the cool tools are being developed with machine learning, I think the money should follow, because, you know, I've seen a lot of like angel investors look at what's coming out of founders' ideas, and because an LLM is so easy to use, most people are like, we don't have a moat, we're just along for the roller coaster. We don't know what our defensibility is going to be as a business, because like it's so accessible to build. And those that do actually do the hard work of the data and the problem, I think, you know, let's make sure that those are problems that address societal well-being, not just like more money in pockets of billionaires.
I love that optimism. So we want to end on a high note. One is, I hope we've covered pretty much all the questions that came up, but we also wanted to end on a high note because there is a lot of, oh, AI workers, will we lose all our jobs? Will it exacerbate inequality, etc.? So we're going to end on a flimsy high note, which is, if you could have one consumer product that will exist in the next 3 to 5 years, or you wish will exist in the next 3 to 5 years that you can actually just buy with a normal amount of dollars, what would it be? Let's go, Claire.
So I was blown away by the Figures AI demo yesterday, the robot that was putting away, washing up. Haby and I were talking about this earlier. Give me a robot that will wash and dry and iron my clothes. I cannot wait to have that thing in my house. Like, bring on the embodied AI. That is what I want in my life in the next 3 years. What about you, Hebe?
I mean, my boyfriend and I have this conversation every Sunday, so I would plus one to that. I would also say that I would love us to have tools that use AI to help us track our usage of AI and our screens and our technology. I think we're on the cusp of people realizing that these things are actually kind of dangerous to our health if we don't use them effectively. And I think everyone is talking about it. Jay Shetty was talking about it. Simon Sinek has an amazing YouTube about this. So I would love to see a device that helps me moderate my consumption and moderate my diet of media and screens.
I am really looking forward to a personal assistant that can take actions on my behalf. And this is also a call out to what Haby mentioned earlier around an agent-based setup where a LLM can help take actions and is capable of taking actions on your behalf. So what I'm looking forward to is the following scenario. It's Sunday night. I'm kind of tired. And a personal assistant pings me. Let's call it Zed, and Zed says to me, Kate, you're due to go into the office on Wednesday and Thursday, but I just checked the news, and because we live in London, there's rail strikes on Wednesday. How about going in on Tuesday? And I say, great, thanks for checking. Zed says back to me, okay, but you booked a gym class on Wednesday. I'm going to cancel that for you on your app. How about I suggest a class on Tuesday, and if I look at your office to the distance between your office and the gym, I can find you a class at, say, 7:30. Happy for me to book that. Take that action. And I say, yes, thank you. Kate, you've also not ordered your groceries for the week. Can I get the usual? And I say, absolutely. Zed says, great, that comes to £40. Can I make that transaction for you? Please go ahead. Kate, I've noticed you've booked flights to Barcelona, but I've checked your Airbnb and your booking.com and you don't have any accommodation. Of course, I haven't booked that. All right, Kate, what I'm going to do is gather some options. I'm going to find four recommendations based on your average price range that you spent in the past. I'll send you those recommendations at like 8:30 tonight when you're on the way home. Happy? Oh, great. I'll have mental capacity to make that decision. Also, it's your dad's birthday coming up. can I source some gifts for him? I know that he lives in South Africa in an outlying area. I'm going to find a places that deliver. And I also noticed that your bank balance is looking a little bit low. So I'm going to make sure that the price point is under $50 for this gift. Yes, happy. I just imagine a world in which the mental load of organizing my life gets outsourced and is thought proactively on my behalf by something else, and that is a world in which I would pay $20 a month for something. Maybe a quick willingness to pay test. Anybody else paying $20 a month for that? There we go.
But what about $100 a month?
There we go.
What if all your data got sold to big tech companies and it wasn't your data and you weren't private anymore? Would you pay $20 a month for that?
Would you pay $100 for the private or $20 for the sold data? Private? Sold data. Really interesting. Well, I don't think we could end on a higher note than that because it seems like the willingness to pay in this room is pretty fantastic. Thank you all so much. I hope you found that informative and enjoyable, and we'll be outside if you've got any more questions.